Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action.
I'd always thought of it as beautiful, flying in the nice, clean air, not this dirty capitalist business down below. But then it suddenly occurred to me, well, that's actually learning to kill. Did I want to spend my life learning to kill?
As we look back at the 20th century, we invariably find ourselves focusing on the many conflicts, wars, and battles that so clearly define the period. In fact, many historians have dubbed the 20th century the Bloody Century. As People's historian Howard Zinn has noted, conventional retrospectives and histories tend to focus on wars and those who fight and win them. Comparatively little attention, however, is paid to the civilians who suffer in war, and even less to those who oppose war or refuse to participate in it. And so, as a new century unfolds, Bruderhof Radio presents a three-part series featuring men and women who have opposed war and the machinery that drives it. Just as war has changed dramatically from the bloody entrenchments of World War I to the precision bombing of Serbia and the Persian Gulf in 1999, so the face of resistance has also changed. In the early part of the century, two massive world wars presented the largest target for resistance and activism. Today, as evidenced by the WTO protests in November 1999, global capitalism and corporatism hold our attention. But the spirit of protest and resistance survives. Today, in part one of our series titled Roots of Resistance, we examine those who spoke out against the carnage of World War II. 1930s Britain was a country still reeling from the casualties of World War I. For many, it had been the war to end all wars, and indeed had claimed, as the poet Wilfred Owen wrote, more than half the seed of Europe. But as Hitler's Nazis mounted strength in Germany, the sabers of war again rattled across Europe. Arthur Wolston, now 85, recalls how the specter of World War I influenced his early beliefs as a young man living in Britain.
Looking back, I would say in the 1930s, there was still quite a, there was even then quite a strong anti-war feeling. And I know, for instance, that the League of Nations, that was there before the United Nations, they organised a vote all over England, going from house to house. And the, one of the main questions, well, I think it was the time when Italy had already declared war and had taken Ethiopia. And there's a big outcry in England about that. And a lot of talk about applying sanctions, and this vote largely went around that. Do you agree this is right? You know, should there be sanctions? There's an overwhelming vote against sanctions. And also at this time, now, Oxford University has quite an influence, and the Oxford Union had met in the middle 1930s in a debate. I think it was something like, are you ready to die for king and country, you know? And the big majority were against that, you know. And it must have been so widespread that even Hitler, this is what I've read since, Hitler believed there would not be much opposition in England.
But despite the indications of a widespread commitment to peace, it took only a few images of Hitler's massive rallies to again rouse Britons to nationalist fervor. According to Wolston, the possibility of war and even invasion caused many peace advocates to change their minds. He, however, remained a pacifist and credits several personal experiences that served to galvanize this decision.
I happened to get in touch with a group called the Hobos, who were young socialists. And that was the thing that opened my eyes, because for the first time from them, I heard about the opium wars in China. How Britain had declared war on China, trying to force them to import opium from India. You know, India belonged to the British Empire then, and the big landowners were growing opium, and they wanted to sell it, and China was the biggest market. And so there were two or three at least, opium wars, which were brought about by England threatening China. And that opened my eyes to what world empire is really like, you know, imperialism. And from that time on, because I started reading more about that kind of thing. And when the war did come, there's a lot of disillusionment by this British imperialism. Right from the, I should say, even the end of the last century, or the middle of the last century even, there'd been a strong socialist movement in England. By that time, from the beginning of the century, the Labour Party, which was the people's, the working class party, had obtained at least a power, the possibility of sitting in Parliament. And so that was also a thing that influences quite a lot. Of course, they were advocating world brotherhood and were absolutely against this, what they call the imperialistic conservative party, which is the party that backed the king and the upper nobility and that type of thing, the old status quo. So it was quite a revolutionary undertone all this time.
As a result, many young people made at least ideological decisions to become conscientious objectors or pacifists. Woolston reflects on his experience as a conscientious objector early in World War II.
As a result of the First World War, there had been no such recognition for conscientious objectors. You had no choice. You had to go into the army, or a few, like the Quakers, went to prison. But there wasn't much communication about pacifism, you know. The First World War especially was a terrifically patriotic surge, you know. And quite a number did go to prison. But as a result, and due to this reaction against that war, there'd been a strong peace movement grow up right through the... right through the 20s and 30s, so that when the, I presume it might have been a Labour government that was in power at the time, they passed, it must have been to do with some sort of military service law, that they made this clause about recognition of conscientious objectors. So in actual fact, we were actually have to thank those who suffered in the First World War that we were in that situation, that you were given that option, you know. And there were quite a number. I mean, it wasn't overwhelming. It wasn't so supported by the churches and chapels as much as one would have thought, you know. Most of the parsons were influenced by... Well, you know, the propaganda that Hitler's a madman, you have to really control him put him in a place where he can't carry on, you know. That was the sort of attitude. And
Woolston himself soon faced increasing animosity from those around him. But worse even than the propaganda, he says, was the basic acceptance of war inherent in the culture. John Hind, a contemporary of Arthur Woolston's, was raised in Britain under the assumption that he would become a career military person. Like Woolston, Hind eventually came to oppose war through a variety of personal experiences.
From the age of about 6, I was determined to become a pilot. And pretty well the only way to become a pilot in those days was to join the Royal Air Force. And that I was going to do. When I was old enough to become a bugler in the Officers' Training Corps, the OTC, which is similar to ROTC in this country, I think I was 12. I did that, and I went right through the whole works to what was called Certificate A, which enables you to be an officer in the Territorial Army and in peacetime, and a regular officer in wartime, which my brother actually was then. What actually changed my mind is hard to say. There were certain things that happened. One rather remarkable thing, at one of these big camps of the Officers' Training Corps, there were 4,000 boys, a brigade camp from all over England each year. And they had a big tent, a library tent, and there was a book by a well-known author, Beverly Nichols, called Cry Havoc, and that got in there, and it was strongly against war, and we read it in our tent. And certainly the boy who was tent commander and I think one other boy, turned out to be very much against war several years later. And things like that, but they didn't work immediately. They worked on us. I also had an uncle who had a lot of left book club books, and I spent a summer with him and read a lot of things on socialism and that kind of thing, which opened my mind to different ideas of what was wrong with the capitalist society. And all these things kind of gelled inside me. But I still went ahead, made an application in 1937 for the Royal Air Force College, and was about to enter when I began to think, well, what is that actually? I'd always thought of it as beautiful, flying in the nice clean air, not this dirty capitalist business down below. My dad wanted me to be a lawyer, which I thought was also dirty business. But then it suddenly occurred to me, well, that's actually learning to kill. Did I want to spend my life learning to kill?
Hind chose to postpone military service and eventually began work at Lloyd's of London. There, he came in contact with other young people also struggling to reconcile their pacifist notions with a generally hawkish mood pervasive in Britain at that time. Many joined the Peace Pledge Union, a national movement in which members pledged to never take part in war.
And of course I heard about the Peace Pledge Union, which was a simple pledge. I think it was simply, I renounce war and will never take part in it. Or something very simple like that, which almost anybody, whatever his faith, could sign. There were 100,000 or 200,000 people signed that in England then. And there were groups in every city in the country. So I joined that. I'd sell peace news on the Streatham High Street Saturday evenings. And then my firm asked me to be junior broker, actually, not in the office anymore, but actually in Lloyd's itself, in the room, in capital letters. And there I got in contact with many people. Most of them wore Territorial Army badges and spoke with really very fine British accents. And I wore my PPU, Peace Pledge Union badge, the only one, in about 1,000 people in that room. And I had many questions. Actually, not too antagonistic, but interested. And I found there were many other people who were actually felt against war but didn't know one another. So I then organized a peace pledge union group in Lloyd's by advertising in Peace News.
Although the Peace Pledge Union was by far the largest peace organization active in Britain at that time, other pacifist groups were also gaining members. It seemed that while the nations wasted thousands of men on the beachheads of Europe, some young people at least sensed the inherent futility of war and were searching for alternatives. You're listening to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. If you have questions or comments about our program, give us a call at 1-800-778-8461 or visit us on the internet at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof. Across the Atlantic, the anti-war movement was less apparent. Caught in the throes of Depression-era isolationism, the threat of World War seemed far off, and most Americans were less concerned with Hitler than with making the next paycheck. All that changed after Pearl Harbor, but until then, pacifism and conscientious objection seemed mostly the realm of the Church or the Communist Party. Arnold Mommsen was of draft age during World War II, and became a conscientious objector while studying at Hamline University in Minnesota. As in Britain, the legal rights of COs had been established in the U.S. during the First World War. The right to grant exemptions was given to local draft boards with varying degrees of sympathy for pacifists.
Men who were aware of it could register as a CO and meet with their draft board and try to get the classification of 4E, which is a conscientious objector, or 1AO. Some of them took alternative service, serving in the army but non-combatant. And some guys had a terrible battle getting the 4E classification with a real tough draft board, very pro-war, red, white, and blue American kind of draft board. I had no trouble at all. I don't think I was even questioned by the draft board, but got a 4E classification very easily. And in November of 1942, I got a railroad ticket to a place in Michigan to my first civilian public service camp near Manistee, Michigan. And the whole CPS program was administered by Selective Service, but sponsored by the three peace churches. And they did so-called work of national importance under civilian direction.
Before the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941, the peace movement in the U.S. seemed most evident in individual conscientious objectors and draft resistors. But as U.S. involvement in the war escalated, so did the opposition movement. Groups such as the People's Peace Now Committee vigorously spoke out against the saturation bombing of Germany. Over 150 civilian public service camps were established to hold objectors to military service, and many other men served jail time for refusing even to register for the draft. In 1945, Dick Nomer was serving with the U.S. Navy in the Pacific Theater when an unexpected rendezvous with the USS Indianapolis prompted him to seriously re-examine his role in the war. Although unaware at the time, Domer later discovered that the ship had been carrying the atomic bombs to be dropped on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Later, while stationed at a field hospital in the Philippines, Domer further developed his convictions.
This fleet hospital had a pretty good library, so I used the time to read a lot and it was through the reading during these months in the jungle there that my whole attitude was changed and became more focused. One of the main influences on me was through reading Thoreau's Walden. And it was not only the military question, but the whole society that I began to question. And also through other reading. And in the end, I felt that when I got back from and was discharged, I had to find a different way of life. I would not fit into society as it was. There was tension right away when the war ended between the United States and Russia. I was still in the Philippines, and I felt then that if war started again, that I would desert.
Although the World War was officially over, a new kind of war was just beginning. It was the Cold War, and the enemy was not a nation, but the possibility of mutually assured destruction. Like many activists of the time, Domer and his wife Lois Ann became involved in the growing movement to oppose nuclear proliferation.
After the atom bombs were dropped and were used, and it was clear what terrible weapons they were, there was a strong protest movement in the United States especially against nuclear armaments, stronger than than had been in any time during the war. And from the atom bomb, the United States was developing and developed the hydrogen bomb, which was worse. And the tensions with Russia grew very strong. We considered being part of this movement and perhaps traveling around, demonstrating and giving speeches. There were different groups who were doing that, trying to educate the public. But we finally felt that we had to leave the United States. And we wrote to the State Department telling them that we wanted to renounce our citizenship. We got a letter back from Mrs. Shipley, who was a person who answered, telling us that we couldn't renounce our citizenship in the country. So we made plans to leave the country after I graduated.
The Domers traveled to Europe. The destruction caused by the war was deeply disturbing, and it started them on a search for a completely new society, one that eliminated the need for war. After returning to the United States in 1950, they spent time at several intentional communities before settling as full-time communitarians and workers for peace and justice. Likewise, Arthur Wolston, John Hind, and Arnold Mompson have remained tireless advocates for peace. Sadly, it seems that many others, including members of the Peace Pledge Union in Britain and conscientious objectors in the U.S., reverted to their pre-war lifestyles. Hind and Mompson explain.
Very many went. Very many changed. There weren't that many who stuck it out. I guess they weren't really convinced enough. And of course, you know, Hitler looked such a terrible menace. Even one of the most forceful speakers for the Peace Pledge Union, John Middleton Murray, in the end turned around against it.
I have a directory of men who were in civilian public service, about 12,000 men, and about 5,000 of them are still listed in the directory. And of those who have contacted by letter or by telephone, it's dismaying to see that most of them, after having taken quite a difficult stand in order to stand up for their beliefs, they have settled back to into good old comfortable middle-class American life and don't champion any causes or stand up for anything anymore, almost universally.
But while many who opposed World War II in the 1940s have since abandoned their nonviolent beliefs, the history of resistance to war continues. While most World War II resistors saw their actions as personal life-changing experiences, later wars, such as Vietnam, witnessed a new kind of mass activism that shook the global war machine to the core. In part two of our series on the roots of resistance, we'll speak with activists from the 1960s and 70s. Of course, the face of resistance is changing even today. While wars continue to rage around the world, today's activists are focusing their fight on global corporatism and the world economy. In part three of our series, we'll talk to the new generation of activists, most recently visible in Seattle. Stay tuned. You've been listening to the first segment of Ritterhoff Radio's three-part look at major movements in activism and protest throughout the 20th century. Ritterhoff Radio is produced by Andrew Zimmerman and Ben Wright. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, call us at 800-778-8461. Again, that's 1-800-778-8461. To order tapes and transcripts, call that same number. Ritterhoff Radio is a production of the Ritterhoff Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for.